Strangers, today is the first day of the year that I was able to go sit outside first thing in the morning. Spring is here, and summer is not far behind. It's time to put away your cashmere and replace it with cool linens and cottons. And if you thought Quince was just for cozy sweaters and all things warm and toasty for winter, it's time to get yourself acquainted with Quince's warm weather lineup. I'm getting myself a linen square neck jumpsuit in light cargo green, a linen camp shirt in soft yellow, and some tees and tanks. And I am telling you, if I still wore dresses, I'd be getting myself a button front dress in black. Quince's styles and quality are amazing, but one thing I really love about Quince is that they only work with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. Listen, you can spend way less from those fast fashion places, but you're gonna be replacing all that stuff when it inevitably pills or falls apart. Plus, Quince's styles are timeless, so unlike that schmata you bought from you-know-where for $5, everything you buy from Quince will last in both quality and style. But don't think you're gonna break the bank on just a few pieces. Because Quince works directly with factories and cuts out the middleman, their items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. More quality, less guilt, better prices. What more could you want from a clothing company? Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/strange for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/strange to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/strange. Do you imagine leaving a legacy? Do you want to be remembered decades beyond your death? Would you like to know that your contribution could change the lives of millions for generations to come? What if your legacy achieved all that, but still no one knew your name? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I'm a writer and podcaster who is just as suspicious about Western medicine as the next guy, but not suspicious enough to not drink the tap water, if you know what I mean. As with anything, there are good actors and bad actors when it comes to medicine. I'd like to believe that most people who decide to go into medicine do it with good intentions. I can't imagine anyone willingly going to that much school and taking on that much debt just so they could play Operation, but on real people, and see how many times they can make the buzzer buzz before the patient dies. There are always the nefarious outliers, I suppose, but for now, I want to believe that generally people are good. That even some who do terrible things are still fundamentally good, but took a wrong turn somewhere along the way and got their wires crossed. And there are those who do terrible things believing it to be for the greater good. That you can't make an omelet without cracking an egg or two. But some of those, even with the best of intentions, seem to forget that the eggs they're cracking are actual human beings. In the case of Henrietta Lacks, it may be impossible to know which kinds of people her doctors were, if they had good intentions or not. Regardless, you know what they say about intentions. In a small cabin in Roanoke, Virginia, on August 1, 1920, Eliza Pleasant gave birth to her 10th and final child, Loretta. She died shortly after Loretta was born due to complications during labor. No one remembers how her name changed from Loretta to Henrietta, but Henrietta, or Henny, was what she was called for most of her life. After his youngest child's birth and his wife's death, Henrietta's father, Johnny Pleasant, suddenly found himself the ill-equipped single parent of a brood of 10, and so did what many before and after him have had to resort to. Moved himself and his children to Clover, Virginia, closer to his family for more support and help with the children. Ultimately, Johnny ended up offloading his children onto family members, which, frankly, was a better choice than a lot of parents in his kind of situation had to make, which was putting their children in an orphanage. Around 1924, Henrietta, then 4 years old, went to live with her grandfather, Tommy Lacks, in a two-story cabin where their enslaved ancestors lived, on land owned by the family that had formerly enslaved them. In her new home, Henrietta shared a room with her first cousin, 9-year-old David Day Lacks. And if that makes you uncomfortable, just wait. Henrietta's childhood was relatively normal for kids like her in her day. She and her cousin Day walked 2 miles each way to the segregated school until each had to drop out to get jobs to help support the family. It wasn't tremendously unusual for kids to drop out of school after what we call junior high school or middle school in order to go to work to contribute to their family's livelihood. High school wasn't compulsory yet, and as with many families all over the world today, there was more value in putting their children to work than having them continue their education. Henrietta made it through to 6th grade before needing to drop out to go to work. Day had dropped out some grades earlier. After leaving school, Henrietta worked at a tobacco farm, feeding animals, tending the gardens, and eventually was sent into the fields to tend and harvest the crop. Remember when I said the thing about being uncomfortable that a very young girl was sharing a room with a boy 5 years her senior? When Henrietta was just 14, she gave birth to her first child, Lawrence Lax, likely in the same room in which he'd been conceived, the bedroom Henrietta and her cousin Day shared. 4 years later, her daughter Elsie was born. Elsie suffered from epilepsy and cerebral palsy, conditions the family would refer to as being different or deaf and dumb. I can only imagine how hard day-to-day life was for the young Lax family. In 1940, when Henrietta was 20 and Day was 25, the couple married. They would have 3 more children, David, Sonny, in 1947, Deborah in 1949, and Joseph in 1950. Joseph was born just 4.5 months before Henrietta's cancer diagnosis and believed his birth to be a miracle as he grew in the womb with literal cancer cells growing all around him. In the mid-40s, as World War II escalated in Europe, the demand on American manufacturing grew exponentially. Henrietta and her family moved to Maryland to get in on the steel boom brought forth by all the bombing of women and children overseas. Fun fact, war is a great way to boost the economy. Unless yours is the country the war is waged upon, of course. Bethlehem Steel supplied the government with a bunch of war stuff, and while the company built housing for white workers in nearby Dundalk, it made absolutely no investment in their black workers who were forced to find lodgings farther away. Henrietta and Dave moved to Turner Station, where the black steel workers built their own homes, eventually building what would become the largest black community in Baltimore County. Henrietta and Day bought a house in Turner Station with the help of some money given to them by another cousin. By the time the United States officially entered the Second World War, fun fact, the U.S. apparently didn't care much about the concentration camps or the beginning stages leading up to the Final Solution, until the war came to us in the attack on Pearl Harbor. The Lax were living on New Pittsburgh Avenue in Turner Station, Baltimore County, Maryland. Only a few months after Henrietta gave birth to Deborah in 1949, she told her cousins Margaret and Sally about a knot inside her. Something definitely didn't feel right. Margaret and Sally asked her if she might be pregnant again. It turned out her cousins were right. Henrietta was pregnant again, but she knew this pain was different. She also knew this pain was different from the various STIs that Day continually brought home, very likely including HPV. Less than 5 months after giving birth to Joseph, Henrietta began spotting. According to Rebecca Skloot's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lax, during a self-exam, she found what, quote, she expected to find, a lump on her cervix, which is frankly remarkable. A frighteningly large percentage of women today apparently don't know what slash where their cervix is. To be fair, of course, Henrietta didn't know what body part she was feeling, but she knew enough to know that whatever was protruding off of it wasn't supposed to be there. Her doctor did a quick exam and, given her medical history, concluded the lump was a syphilis sore. But when she tested negative for syphilis, the doctor was like, this is above my pay grade, and sent her to the gynecology clinic at Johns Hopkins, a 20-mile drive from her home. Fortunately for Henrietta, not only was Hopkins one of the most respected and prominent hospitals in the country, it also happened to be one of the very few hospitals in the city that admitted patients regardless of their race or ethnicity, though in their own segregated sections, obviously. And so, on January 29, 1951, they dropped Henrietta off in front of the clinic, where she would have to wait in a segregated waiting room and would be housed in a segregated ward. In the exam room, Henrietta described the knot to Dr. Howard Jones. Henrietta, like many women who knew very little about their own biology, had never heard words like cervix or biopsy, but she knew something was wrong. When he examined her, he found the lump where she had described it. Jones treated thousands of patients for cervical cancer, but hadn't seen anything like this lesion. He described it as a, quote, eroded hard mass about the size of a nickel, and shiny and purple, like grape jello. Jones took a biopsy to send to the pathology lab down the hall and told Henrietta to go home and await his call. In his notes after the exam, Dr. Jones included that when she gave birth to Joseph on September 19, 1950, only 3 months earlier, no abnormality was noticed on her cervix. So either the doctors missed it or that tumor had, quote, grown at a terrifying rate. Strangers, my son has somehow talked me into doing a hot wings challenge. There are 8 hot sauces currently sitting on my table, taunting me with the promise of a destroyed digestive system. Thankfully, for my insides and my plumbing, I've been taking Ritual and Symbiotic Plus. With Ritual's 3-in-1 supplement, including clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support the relief of mild and occasional bloating, gas, and diarrhea, I'll likely be sitting pretty while my son sits on the toilet. My mouth will surely be on fire, but with Ritual, my butt won't be. I keep my Ritual and Symbiotic Plus right on my desk, so I always remember to take it with my blood pressure and my ADHD medications. Look at me, supporting my heart, brain, and gut. It's almost like I'm a responsible adult who cares about their own health and well-being, except for this stupid hot wings challenge. In a study modeling the human colon, Symbiotic Plus significantly increased microbial diversity and the growth of beneficial bacteria. Plus, Ritual not only supports a healthy gut biome, but it also helps support a healthier environment. Ritual uses scientific tools to select lower carbon packaging, prioritize sustainably sourced ingredients, and set ambitious climate goals. There's no more shame in your gut game. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide your insides. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/strange. Start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/strange for 25% off. It just so happened that Dr. Jones's boss, Dr. Richard Tallend, was not only one of the top cervical cancer experts in the U.S., but he'd also been noodling around with a theory that he believed could save millions of women. On its face, this would have been terrific news for Henrietta. What luck she lived relatively close to one of the best doctors around, who happened to be an expert in just the thing she needed an expert in. Tallend's theory was that if more doctors knew how to interpret results from a relatively new procedure called the Pap smear, they could not only decrease the mortality rate of cervical cancer, which before the Pap was invented was more than 15,000 women a year, but could also decrease the number of unnecessary hysterectomies that apparently doctors were handing out like lollipops. For those of you who aren't of the cervical persuasion, a pap smear is a test done where they swab the cervix and then test the cells for abnormalities. Apparently, before the pap, doctors were like, something looks wrong in there. Let's remove the entire thing. It's like taking out the engine because there's an oil leak. But aside from the fact that many doctors still didn't understand how to analyze the results of a pap smear, a huge majority of women still weren't getting pap smears. So Tallend's idea wasn't exactly revolutionary. He just wanted to make the practice and understanding of paps more universal to help prevent death from cancer. It's not like he invented anything. He was literally just like, let's use this thing that's already invented. And so, in order to help doctors better identify cancer cells in pap results, Tallend needed cancer cells. So he handed each patient a clearly worded, easy-to-understand consent form so they were aware of what was being done with parts of their body. Ha 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 ha, JK. He just took people's cells. Like the Hamburglar takes burgers, complete with a robble-robble, I'm assuming. Apparently, it was common practice to treat the hospital's non-paying patients, those who qualified for free treatment, usually black people, like test subjects without their knowledge or consent. Can I get a Tuskegee, anyone? Basically, the attitude was that testing on the patients was a form of payment. They just didn't run any of it by the actual patients involved. It seems that doctors were like, for the privilege of getting medical care, we can do whatever we want to you. Plus, also, the idea of medical consent was newish, anyway. It wasn't until the horrors of what Dr. Joseph Mengele did during the Holocaust became public that getting consent from patients became common practice. Still, consent wasn't a legal requirement by 1951, and even in places where it was generally practiced, there were plenty of doctors skirting the law. Dr. Talind and his department were among them, and Henrietta became an unwitting participant in Talind's quest for cancer cells, with some of her cells going to the lab for testing and others being put in storage with dollar signs on them. And I'm sure I don't need to point out that none of those dollars ever made it into Henrietta's hands, or for that matter, her descendants' hands, as her cells would go on to make the hospital money for decades. Dr. Jones called Henrietta on February 5th to tell her the biopsy report had come back and it wasn't good news. The tumor was malignant, an epidermoid carcinoma of the cervix. Whether or not she understood the gravity of the diagnosis, I don't know, but Henrietta thanked him, hung up the phone, and continued with her day. What else could she do? The following day, Henrietta took herself back to Johns Hopkins and was admitted for treatment. Her first treatment involved thin glass tubes filled with radium sewn into her cervix. Listen, I don't even know where to begin with this or how to process it or what to do with myself right now. With one tube sewed inside her cervix and another sewed to the outside, a third tube was packed against it, held there by gauze and hope, apparently. Henrietta didn't consent to having samples taken of both the cancerous and healthy cells. She didn't even know it was happening. The samples were placed into a glass dish and sent to George Gay, head of tissue culture research at Johns Hopkins. For about 20 years, Gay and his wife Margaret worked together, determined to grow the first immortal human cells, a continuously dividing line of cells all descended from one original sample. Cells that would constantly replenish themselves and never die. The Gays, accompanied by their assistant, Mary Kubitschek, prepared the samples in test tubes and labeled them per lab procedures, using the first two letters of the patient's first and last name, He-La. And pretty soon, Kubitschek noticed the cancerous cells were multiplying while the healthy cells died. Meanwhile, back at home, Henrietta kept her diagnosis a secret. Nothing changed in her routine other than the occasional trip back to Hopkins for additional treatments and checkups. Pleased the tumor was shrinking, doctors switched Henrietta to X-ray radiation therapy, which, while a welcome change from the radium treatments, was harder to keep secret. The treatment required her to visit Hopkins every weekend for a month. Day could take her to her treatments, but he worked nights and wasn't able to pick her up. Henrietta's cousin Margaret lived only a few blocks from the hospital. Henrietta could walk there after treatments and wait for Day to pick her up. A few weeks into her treatments, Henrietta developed what she must have thought were gnarly side effects, including a burning sensation in her nether region and painful urination. But it wasn't side effects. It was yet another STI brought home by her husband who somehow managed to accuse her of giving it to him. Right. With all her free time in between her weekly treatments for cervical cancer, Henrietta was off hopping on whatever dick she could find. Because that makes sense. This fucking guy. To make matters worse, the radium was starting to take a toll. The few blocks between the hospital and her cousin's house began to feel longer and longer. One day, she almost collapsed, and it took her nearly an hour to walk just that short distance. By June, she told her doctor she could feel the illness growing inside her. But, and stop me when this starts to sound familiar, doctors dismissed her feelings, writing in her chart, quote, "Patient states that she feels fairly well, however she continues to complain of some vague abdominal discomfort. No evidence of recurrence. Return in 1 month," end quote. I'm shocked they didn't include telling her to lose weight and get more exercise. Strangers, Rocket Money is back to blast more savings into your life. Wow, I am really good at writing. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Listen, when we moved, I may or may not have forgotten to update my address with a subscription service that sent building kits once a month for my son. It wasn't until months later that the tenant who'd moved into our old apartment was like, you may want to do something about this. I had completely forgotten. I felt like a real dope. If I'd been using Rocket Money, I would have been keeping better track of my subscriptions, and I would have remembered to either update my address or cancel that subscription much sooner. And Rocket Money would have been like, "You're not a dope, you're just busy." And I would have been like, "Aw, thank you, Rocket Money. I'll be kinder to myself from now on." Okay, Rocket Money may not be able to remind you to be kinder to yourself, but it can remind you when you have forgotten subscriptions or you have duplicate subscriptions, which apparently almost 75% of people have. Between all the different ways we pay for things now and the vagueness of a lot of the language on banking statements, it's not hard to forget what you're paying for and where. That's why Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/unexplained. That's rocketmoney.com/unexplained. rocketmoney.com/unexplained. Author and historian Rebecca Skloot found no indication that Henrietta questioned the doctor's opinion, but Skloot does give the doctors way more credit than I think they were due when she wondered whether the doctor was trying to spare Henrietta's feelings by not telling her how serious her disease actually was. I'll tell ya, I'd much rather have my feelings hurt and find out I'm dying than have the doctors pat me on the hand and tell me everything is fine when they know it's not. By July 1951, Henrietta's pain had gotten so bad that she couldn't pee and she could barely walk. Back at Hopkins, they installed a catheter and sent her home. How do you like that? The woman can barely walk from the pain and they're like, "Here's a catheter, bye-bye now." 3 days later, she returned. This time, however, the doctors, in a rare instance of believing her, did an exam and felt a stony, hard mass. An x-ray validated Henrietta and all of her pain. There, attached to her pelvic wall, was a mass that was nearly blocking her urethra. You mean the cancer you already knew she had spread? What a shock! Just to recap, in her chart, there was one entry that said everything is absolutely fine, and then just weeks later, a medical professional wrote inoperable and patient looks chronically ill. Well, that escalated quickly. Despite having inoperable cancer, looking chronically ill, and being in so much pain she could barely walk, her doctor sent her home without pain medication because she couldn't afford it. I guess her stolen cells weren't worth enough to cover morphine. At home, Henrietta wailed in pain, asking God to help her. A week after her fatal diagnosis, Day drove her back for a follow-up appointment. X-rays showed rapid growth of the cancer, a death knell for Henrietta, and a payday for the hospital. Her abdomen was full of tumors, one on her uterus, one on each kidney, and another on her urethra. Doctors attempted radiation treatments, increasing the radiation every day, hoping they would shrink the tumors. To the medical team, the treatments were a Hail Mary. To Henrietta and her family, they believed they were going to save her. A week after her 31st birthday, Henrietta arrived at Hopkins and her pain was so intense that she asked to be admitted. The note in her chart read, quote, "She has to come in from a considerable distance and it is felt that she deserves to be in the hospital where she can be better cared for," end quote. Another sample was taken for George Gay, who was anxious to see if results would replicate. His hopes were dashed, however. Henrietta's system had become too contaminated with toxins because she couldn't pee. One wonders what the hell the catheter was doing. This new contaminated sample died almost immediately. Henrietta never left Hopkins again. Day brought the children to visit until their visits made everyone too upset. Then he would bring them to sit on a bench beneath her window. She would summon the strength to stumble to the window so she could watch her children play, which is just too sad to dwell on. No pain meds would dull the pain, not even injections directly into her spine. New tumors appeared almost daily, on her lymph nodes, her hip bones, on her labia. Her fever remained steadily at 105. Finally, doctors made the decision to stop the radiation treatments. As the calendar turned to September, the number of tumors grew exponentially, spreading to her diaphragm, bladder, lungs, and intestines. When her kidneys failed, she was put on dialysis, and at least one unnamed doctor ordered a stop to the transfusions, quote, until her deficit with the blood bank was made up, end quote. To be clear, what this guy was saying was, no more blood until you pay up. Cool. When word made its way around the neighborhood that Henrietta needed blood, her cousin Emmett rounded up some friends. Henrietta had become a de facto big sister to Emmett and some of the other young men who'd moved to their neighborhood. Many of them had called her living room home when they'd first moved and eaten pounds of her spaghetti and buttered bread. Once they started work at the steel mill, Henrietta rode the streetcar with them to ensure they didn't get lost. And until they got paid, she packed them lunches and sent extra food along with Day for snacks. So the men felt they owed her. If she needed blood, that was something they could give her. So, Emmett, his brother, and six big steel workers crowded into Henrietta's hospital room, only to see their surrogate big sister now weighed only 100 pounds. They wouldn't stay long, though, as she was hit with an immense wave of pain that sent her body into convulsions, an image that would haunt Emmett for many years to come. The men were escorted down the hall to the room where black people donated blood, because, you know, even their blood was segregated. On September 24, 1951, doctors ordered an end to treatments and essentially put Henrietta into palliative care. A few days later, she turned to her sister Gladys, who'd been sitting by her bedside for days. With tears streaming down her face, Henrietta begged her sister to take care of her children, especially Deborah, only a year old. The last thing she said to her sister was, "Don't you let anything bad happen to them children when I'm gone." That night, Gladys called Day and told him Henrietta was going to die very soon, and her last wish was that her children were safe and sound. Henrietta died on a Thursday, October 4, 1951. She was 32 years old. There was no obituary for Henrietta. The family couldn't afford one. Her coffin was a simple pine box that was transported from Baltimore to Clover by train. When she opened the coffin to help prepare Henrietta's body for the funeral, her cousin Sadie began to cry, not at the sight of her dead cousin, but at her dead cousin's chipped toenail polish. Henrietta always kept her nail polish perfect. Sadie told another family member, "Lord, Henny must have hurt something worse than death to let her polish get all chipped like that." Henrietta was buried during a fierce thunderstorm that one cousin would later say she should have known was Henrietta trying to tell them something. But how could they possibly know that as they put their beloved wife, mother, sister, cousin, and friend to rest, she would become a legacy none of them were aware of? After Henrietta died, George Gay was anxious to get more samples from as many of her organs as possible. But now he had a problem. The law was very clear. You could take a person's cells or inject them with whatever without them knowing, as long as they were alive. But once they were dead, you better get permission from their next of kin if you wanted anything from them. Day remembered someone from the hospital calling him, telling him Henrietta had died, and asking his permission to perform an autopsy. He'd said no, They asked again when he had to identify her body, but this time they said the test they wanted to run might even help his children one day. With that hitting him so soon after losing his wife, he signed the permission form. George Gay's lab assistant, Mary Kubitschek, was sent to retrieve the samples, but froze in the doorway to the morgue. She'd never actually seen a dead body before. Now, it seems she'd have to get pretty intimate with one. Kubitschek's instructions were to get samples from Henrietta's bladder, bowel, uterus, kidney, vagina, ovary, appendix, liver, heart, and lungs, which were all put in petri dishes. Samples from Henrietta's cervix were placed in formaldehyde. It wasn't until she was finished collecting the samples that Kubitschek noticed Henrietta's toenail polish and, for the first time, realized that Henrietta was a person, not just a collection of cells under a microscope lens. Henrietta's official cause of death was listed as terminal uremia, blood poisoning from toxins building up after not being able to pee. Which is bonkers when you think about the tumors that had been popping up faster than they could be noted and had grown to the size of baseballs that sat on several of her organs. I'm no coroner, but I'm pretty sure it was the cancer that killed her. Meanwhile, George Gay was busy working on plans for a HeLa factory, a place where they could grow trillions of Henrietta's cells each week. 1951 not only saw Henrietta's death, but also the largest polio epidemic the world had ever seen. Jonas Salk had developed a polio vaccine, but needed to test it before it could be given to polio's target population, children. Henrietta's cells were just the thing he needed. Up to this point, Salk's lab, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, NFIP, had been using cells harvested from monkeys, which came with several problems. The cells were expensive and kept dying in the testing process. In order to complete the required amount of testing to make sure the vaccine was safe, it would cost millions. The NFIP reached out to cell culture experts, including George Gay, for help. By the time he got NFIP's call, Gay had realized that cells harvested from Henrietta grew outside of the environment cells usually needed, and they kept growing at an unusually rapid pace. Basically, he realized they could keep growing cells as long as they had the space and the cell culture medium stuff. In April 1952, George and William Scherer from the NFIP tested Henrietta's cells and discovered they were exactly what Salk needed for his vaccine tests. Charles Bynum, NFIP's Director of Negro Activities, helped establish a distribution center at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. Yes, that Tuskegee, to oversee shipping and distribution of the HeLa cells. Side note, Charles Bynum was the first Black Foundation executive in the U.S. and helped funnel hundreds of thousands of dollars into Black education and Black STEM. Once it was up and running, NFIP had 35 scientists and techs, many of them women, producing roughly 6 trillion cells a week. Once the polio labs had reached capacity for Henrietta's cells, the Tuskegee Center began to sell tubes to any scientist interested. If you had $10 or $115 in today money, plus shipping, you could get your very own tube of HeLa cells. Why, at that price, who cares about ethics? Strangers, my favorite sheets are back. Listen, I don't know how Miracle Maid does it. I mean, I do. It's silver-infused fabric from technology inspired by NASA. But what am I, an astronaut? I don't know how Miracle Maid keeps me cool and dry while keeping my husband snug as a bug. This man sleeps in a full set of fleece pajamas underneath all the covers. Strangers, is he an alien? Should I be worried? Meanwhile, I'm naked as a jaybird, furiously throwing the comforter off, which disturbs the dog, who then gets up and sighs like she has any bills to pay. Speaking of bills, the silver-infused fabric prevents almost 100% of bacteria growth, which means less laundry for you. That not only saves you on laundry bills, but it also saves time. Besides, no one actually knows how to fold a fitted sheet. come on. And because they stay cleaner, Miracle Made sheets prevent the germs that can cause colds and the bacteria that causes acne. Less laundry and less acne? Yes, please. Go to trymiracle.com/strange to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo code STRANGE at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/strange and use the code STRANGE to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/strange to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Henrietta's cells have directly contributed to huge, groundbreaking discoveries. Because of these cells, a new way of freezing and shipping them was devised. They helped to launch the field of virology. And without virology, we wouldn't have those cute drawings of spheres with spikes coming out of them. I'm just kidding. Some of my best friends are virologists. That's a lie. I only know one virologist. And let me tell you what, that guy is not invited to any of my dinner parties. Henrietta's cells helped scientists learn what happens to cells after exposed to nuclear bombs. They showed what the effects of high-pressure scenarios on the cellular level are. They were used by cosmetic companies who didn't want to test on animals anymore. The U.S. government used them to find treatments for various diseases befalling troops in whatever far-flung parts of the world they were stationed. And they helped create most of our modern vaccines, including the COVID vaccine. Thank you, Henrietta. 3 years after Henrietta's death, one virologist, Chester Southam, working with Henrietta's cells, was like, "Hey, wait, can I get sick from these cells?" And so he injected healthy cells with the HeLa cells. LOL, JK. He injected the cancerous cells into patients, say it with me, without their consent. At first, he used his own patients, those who'd been recently diagnosed with various forms of cancer and had been admitted to Sloan Kettering, who I guess he decided had cancer anyway, so what's the harm? When he ran out of cancer patients, he turned to prisoners, because everyone knows that prisoners don't deserve things like rights or consent over what happens to them. In addition to doctors, prisoners were also at the mercy of chemical companies who wanted to test everything from chemical warfare agents to household cleaners and the impacts of x-rays on the balls for sperm count. Southam's testing was going well, with a seemingly unending buffet of incarcerated men to test on. It probably would have continued for years if it weren't for 3 Jewish doctors at Sloan Kettering who refused to conduct research on anyone without getting their explicit consent. What a concept! Only 16 years since the world watched the Nuremberg trials, where they learned about the horrific medical experimentation the Nazis conducted on Jewish prisoners during the Holocaust, the 3 men repeated the first line of the Nuremberg Code of Ethics, quote, "The voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential," end quote. And they were lauded for their bravery and ethics. Oh, I'm sorry, I misread that. They were accused of being too sensitive because of their Jewish ancestry. Unfortunately for the hospital, someone on their board was a lawyer, William Hyman, who heard about the 3 doctors and asked to see the medical records of the study. His request was denied, while over in Sweden, on the same day, the New York Times reported that a Swedish scientist had been fired for injecting HeLa cells without the patient's consent. Hyman sued Sloan Kettering over their grossly unethical practices. The lawsuit caught the attention of the media, and newspaper stories caught the eyes of Southam's patients, who were like, "Da fuck?" and called reporters. Louis Lefkowitz, the New York State Attorney General, launched an investigation, the report of which had so many exclamation points, you'd think he'd been texting my anxious friend Jordan, who thinks any text without punctuation is an attack. The report accused Southam and his boss of fraud and unprofessional conduct. Lefkowitz wrote, quote, Every human being has an inalienable right to determine what shall be done with his own body. These patients, then, had a right to know the contents of the syringe, and if this knowledge was to cause fear and anxiety or make them frightened, they had a right to be fearful and frightened and thus say no to the experiment. End quote. With these revelations, the National Institute of Health investigated all studies receiving their funding and found that out of 52 projects that involved human test subjects, only 9 had any policy at all to protect the rights of the research subjects. After seeing these results, the NIH issued a new directive. To qualify for funding, all proposals for research on human subjects had to be approved by review boards, which honestly seems to me like just common sense. If you want to use our money, we have to review what you want it for first. While Henrietta's cells were causing quite the stir in the medical and scientific worlds, the Lax family still knew nothing about any of it. They wouldn't learn about HeLa cells until 1973, 22 years after Henrietta was buried in that muddy field during a sudden storm. Henrietta's daughter-in-law, Babette, who married Henrietta's first son, Lawrence, was visiting a friend whose brother was in town from D.C., where he worked at the National Cancer Institute. The trio quickly realized that they were from the same neighborhood. When the friend's brother asked what Babette's last name was, she gave him her married name, Lax. The brother was basically like, "Come again?" An article had just been published naming Henrietta for the very first time as the originator of the cells he worked with every day. And here was a woman with the same last name sitting in front of him. What were the odds? He asked her if she knew a Henrietta Lax. Babette was like, "Yeah, duh, she was my husband's mother, but she died more than 20 years ago." He asked if, by chance, she died of cervical cancer, at which point I imagine Babette was like, "What are you talking about, Willis?" He told her about the article that named her late mother-in-law as the owner of the cells heard round the world. Babette jumped to her feet, yelling, "What do you mean? Who's got cells from my mother-in-law?" On the short walk back to her house to break the news to Lawrence, the images of the Tuskegee syphilis study ran through her head. If they experimented on Henrietta, were they going to come for her children? For her grandchildren? And then, a couple years later in the winter of 75, Michael Rogers, a reporter from Rolling Stone, appeared at the Lax door. Hoping to get more information, Rogers ended up knowing a lot more than Henrietta's family. Apparently, since the family had caught wind of their matriarch's unwitting legacy, doctors showed up asking to get blood samples. Rogers wrote, quote, "It was so clear they hadn't been treated well. They truly had no idea what was going on, and they really wanted to understand. But doctors just took blood samples without explaining anything and left the family worrying," end quote. Rogers' story hit newsstands on March 25, 1976, telling the full story of Henrietta Lax for the first time. At a time when newspapers were still reporting on the horrors of Tuskegee, the Black community's distrust of the healthcare system was in an upswing. The Black Panthers were establishing clinics in cities around the country to offer free medical care for those who no longer felt safe going to doctors, which ultimately got dismantled because racism. Now, Americans were reading about the daughter of enslaved people and sharecroppers who had literal parts of her body taken without her permission, and how the white medical system had been making millions while the family couldn't afford health insurance. While the article brought attention to Henrietta and the idea of informed consent, the Lax family was still struggling to survive. In 1996, the family was invited to attend the Morehouse School of Medicine's first annual HeLa Women's Health Conference, created by Dr. Roland Petillo as a way to recognize Henrietta, her contribution, and the contribution Black Americans have made, quote, to medical research and clinical practice, end quote. The mayor of Atlanta officially declared that day, October 11th, Henrietta Lax Day. The accolades continued. Henrietta received an honorary doctorate in public service from Morgan State University in Baltimore in 2011. In 2014, she was inducted into the Maryland Women's Hall of Fame. a minor planet was named 359426 Lax. Her portrait was hung in the National Portrait Gallery, and she was inducted in the National Women's Hall of Fame. But year after year, the family saw nothing of the profits made since 1951. Until last year. Last year, 2023, more than 70 years after her death. That happened after the family filed a lawsuit in 2021 against Thermo Fisher Scientific Incorporated in Massachusetts, alleging they continued to profit long after the origins of the HeLa cells became well known. Settled out of court and behind closed doors, the amount received by the family was not disclosed, but I'm hoping they now secretly own Massachusetts and Johns Hopkins and the moon. On August 1st, 2023, Henrietta's family gathered by Baltimore's Inner Harbor to celebrate the end of their nightmare and their matriarch's 103rd birthday. Henrietta's cells are still being used in labs all over the world and beyond. Small pieces of an honest woman from Roanoke, Virginia, who hoped to find a better life in Baltimore, traveled to every corner of the planet and even voyaged among the stars as part of a mission to the moon. Her cells have allowed innumerable people to conceive a child via in vitro. They even ended up in school labs, allowing students to perform experiments. Like Erica Johnson, who, as she told author Rebecca Skloot, in the late 90s was in her high school biology class when her teacher told the class the cell line they were working with had originated from tissue taken from a woman named Henrietta Lacks. Erica remembered looking down and thinking, "This is my great-grandmother I'm holding in my hand." Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of Strange and Unexplained. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by Jennifer Erdman and me, Daisy Egan. Researched by Jennifer Erdman, edited by Amber Hunt. Audio editing and engineering by Tanner Werner and Amanda Rossman. For more information on everything Grab Bag has to offer, visit us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. If you have an idea for an episode of Strange and Unexplained, visit our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. If you have filled out the contact form at some point in the last 3 years and didn't receive a reply, please fill out another contact form. Turns out I may have missed all of them. When you contact me, I will write back, unless you're just being mean, in which case you can find the contact form at Joe Rogan's website. Follow the show at SNU Pod and check out Grab Bag Collab and me, Daisy Egan, on Instagram. We are no longer on Twitter because of fascism. Check out our Facebook page to join in the conversation, and I'll see you next time.